Well, we're here again. The Vegas series.
Yeah, yeah.
At the Conrad. To my left, Sugar Ray Nosty.
I'm so happy to be here. How's that?
To my right, Mike Big Roy.
Or a big house that.
And I'm Andrew Dorsey Dawson. And as always, Widow, I'll throw it over to you because we've got another very special guest.
Very interesting guest.
International man of mystery, also, almost.
Yeah.
Name first, Tristan Hay, THM Sport. And you're in communications and managing and giving people the right ideas to promote their products when they go out there, like the NRL here for Vegas. And I got to say, Tristan, man, it's surreal being here. Did you have anything to do with that organisation of last night?
No, I can't take any credit for that. That was, again, Peter Volandi's the chairman and Andrew and all the execs. I mean, they had a big vision, and I think last night kind of blew us all away, to be honest, like thousands of people on the strip. Right. It was crazy,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
I've already said this to Peter Beattie today and Mark Elson. There was electricity in the air. It was just... It was surreal.
Yeah, it was.
And we're in Vegas.
Yeah.
In the arcade at Fremont, and there's 15,000 Aussies there. It's the launch of the NRL, I mean. And imagine if it hadn't been done correctly.
Yeah.
It's a disaster otherwise, isn't it?
And I think, again, you've got to look at Peter and Andrew, and, you know, I think what yesterday showed us is the way sport's going. It's all about the live experience now. And that's why I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this game and about the long-term growth for rugby league in the US, but I don't think you can underestimate that live experience, like the ability to put on a show.
100%.
Even if, you know, let's be honest, probably a lot of the players or the people here in America probably know who Reece Walsh or Cameron Murray or Latrell Mitchell or Tedesco are. But I think when you see it in person, you see the music and the lights.
Fantastic.
And, you know, it just gives it a sense of buzz. And that's, you know, that's where sport's going. You know, I mean, Big Bash, Mike, I mean, you know, again, they kind of set the tone, I guess. And rugby league, certainly, this is a huge endeavour and it's an ambitious plan. But I think, you know, certainly last night showed that the game's on the right path.
THM, let's talk about you. Sydney boy.
Yep.
Yeah. Where from?
So I grew up in the inner west, and I was actually living not far from you now, Mike. So
I'm in South Coogee.
Yeah, I always say where, but I'm not too far, just up the hill.
North Ride.
Yeah. North Ride. So you've got the smell of the ocean, and you just had to go to the coast.
The Gulls.
I'm a little further out from the inner west. I'm at Bankstown. So
yeah. And a boy, a Bulldog supporter. How did you get into this sort of work?
No, I worked.
What's your sporting background?
I played basketball actually as a kid, and probably everyone else here apart from you, like, you know, probably had dreams of playing professional sport, just wasn't good enough. I kind of did a degree, went to Sydney Uni and then graduated and basically just rang up, applied for jobs in TV stations and radio stations, sporting teams, and I ended up landing one at Sky Channel, the horse racing channel, and, you know, it was a pretty low, not low, it was just a pretty basic job, but gave me a bit of a taste, and again, it's like... The one thing you learn about Australia is it's who you know, not necessarily not what you know. And, you know, just that kind of that introduction gave me a taste, and I built a really good network. And from there I got a job at the NRL, and I worked there for about 4 or 5 years.
What year was that? Did you start the NRL?
So I worked for a PR company before that, actually, which was pretty crazy. That was a music, your sport and music kind of PR agency, actually with the late Brian Walsh, who was a...
They're both musicians.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
We've got a band.
Well, I've got a great story for you.
We've got a band at home. Junior plays in the band as well. With all of us. Yeah.
No, it's a good story. So I'll tell you a quick little story.
Please.
So my first proper job. So I graduated uni. I did that little Sky Channel. And I got a call from Brian Walsh, who was a very influential man, the kind of
Reece's
Australian.
Uncle.
Yes. Yeah.
No, he's not. Ray's not Reece's Walsh's uncle. It's a G up. He's G up already.
Yeah, no, very influential man in my life. And he kind of took a punt and gave me a job.
Reece's uncle. Stop it.
he said, listen, I've got a job. It's a 3-month project. But if you do this, I know you're into sport. We'll see how it goes. He said, I've got the Rolling Stones coming out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I got the Rolling Stones for the 40 Licks Tour. This is 2003.
Wow. I've got that too.
Yeah, it's okay. So 40 Licks Tour 2003. So listen, they've got their own PR team. They've got their own management. I've got a senior publicist who's going to do all the work. You said, but they're bringing their kids out. And, you know, I was 22 at the time. I just need someone to be my eyes and ears because, you know, you got kids. You know, if your kids have a good time, then the... Yeah. You know, the band's going to have a good time.
So hang on, you're 22.
Yeah.
The big boss, and the legend has said, the Stones are coming out and I need you to do this for me. Yeah, like, you've got to be going, oh, fuck, crazy, man, that's bizarre, isn't it?
No, it's crazy. So I was living at home with mum and dad, obviously.
Then you go home.
I didn't have a suit.
I'm doing some stuff with Mick Jagger.
And I'm moving out after I get my first paycheck.
True story. I didn't have a suit,
Wow.
I ain't got a suit. Never black car, limo came and picked us up from mum and dad's house.
Unreal.
Went to the airport. You know, like, just, you know, just met them all. Anyway, got in the van back to the hotel. And then, again, I didn't really know what I was doing, but met all the kids and kind of look, you know, hang out with them for a little bit. And
when you say kids, what age?
They would have been 18 to, you know, my age, 22, 23. So they were adults and they wanted to know they were around the city. And, so anyway, so but through that, I learned a great lesson. So so I don't know if that show, they did two stadium shows and they did an intimate gig. And, for you know, Sydney, the two stadium shows were at ASA or what's it called now, Core Stadium.
Yep.
And the intimate show was at the Emore Theatre. Now,
brilliant.
Anyone knows the Emore Theatre. Yeah. I mean, it holds about 1,500 people.
Yeah,
so the tickets sold out for that Emore Theatre show in about 2 minutes, right? It was huge. It was that big, actually, on the show. All these people turned up trying to get in. They had to block off Emore Road.
Oh, outside, right, trying to get in the theatre.
Open the doors. Oh, mate, it's unbelievable. Anyway, so...
Doesn't happen to us.
Not yet.
Yeah, gay champion.
Yeah, so after about a day or two, just kind of hanging around, we stayed at the Four Seasons in the city. And
what do you mean hanging? Are you talking about Mick Jagger?
Oh, it's crazy, mate.
Keep going.
Yeah, right? It's crazy. So,
don't miss anything out.
Yeah, no, I'll give you the short version. Anyway, so... Pretty, again, like anything, you kind of quickly figure out who's who in the zoo. And there was a lady, you know, she would have been probably, you know, late 50s, but you could quickly tell she was like a manager, but she was like their mum. So basically, she was the glue. And anyway, quickly, you know, we just kind of got on well, and she had this room that overlooked the Harbour Bridge at the Four Seasons Hotel. And one day I had to go and pick up some tickets or accreditation or something, and then I said that, you know, it's great, what a view. She said, I said, you know, you can actually climb the Harbour Bridge now. She said, you know what, Tristan, I've been here, you know, back and forth the last 30 years, and I've never even been outside to have a look at the Harbour Bridge. I said, I'll tell you what, tomorrow morning, I'm going to get us a couple of tickets. We're going to get up at 6, there's like an hour and a half tour.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it. Yeah. She goes, oh, no, I can't. I said, no, please. I'll, you know, want to
she
do
fell,
it.
Didn't she?
No, I would be here today. Okay. She did.
Okay, sorry.
Anyway, so we got up, we did the tour, and, you know, she had a great time, and... Anyway, she just said, you know, thank you so much. Got the, you know, get the photo on top of the bridge and all that kind of stuff. And then she said, listen.
It is special, but it's something special to do.
We take it for granted, right?
Yeah,
when they don't fall, it's good.
They're actually tagged on with a belt.
I've never been on a belt.
No, it was very special. And then... anyway, so she said, now listen, you need tickets. And obviously, you know, rule when you have a job, you don't. And I said, no, I'm fine. Like, I've got a couple of tickets. She said, no, Tristan, I want to give you some tickets. You want some tickets? And I said, you know, if you got something, you know, I'd love to take my mum and dad would love to go, you know. And she's like, okay, no problem. So she gave me these two tickets. Oh, front row, front middle of that Emore Theatre show.
Oh,
yeah, the one that sold out. Mum and Dad had the best experience of their
life.
And
were they Stones fans, your mum and Dad?
Oh, huge Stones fans.
What a night for them.
And then, the other cool thing about that, so I mean, it was an amazing experience, but and it's come out, obviously, with cricket. Obviously, Charlie Watts was a huge cricket fan. Yeah. Mick Jagger loves his cricket. Yeah. So we actually, the only request they had, my part of big project, really, apart from making sure the kids didn't get too much trouble, was to get AB down from Brisbane.
Oh, wow.
And he came down to Brisbane because I don't think they played in Brisbane for this tour. So, but Charlie and Mick really wanted to meet AB, so he brought him down, came backstage and talked cricket. That was actually the highlight. Yeah.
Charlie and Mick Jagger want to meet AB.
Yeah.
It was just, I mean, literally, this is... Tristan, I got a question for you. Okay. How was Keith? I want to know about Keith.
Yeah, he hasn't got any fingers.
Wow.
No, he was nocturnal. Again, I remember because I was
nocturnal.
Well, they gave me, because I was the young, you know, like, can I swear on the air?
Yes, you can.
I was like the shit kicker, so they give me the job.
Cut that.
So I was a guy, and you can, you know, Mike, you can appreciate this. Like, I was a guy that had to, this is before, mobile phones were out, but I was a guy that had to go and knock on the door, you know, today's show or
Doug Mulroy
was back then. Yeah, whoever Doug was. Mulroy.
Denton, the boy genius.
It was Andrew Dare, would have been. Anyway, so I was like, breakfast radio. No one wanted to do it. You'd ring their room, they wouldn't answer, their phone would be off the hook, so I'd be the one that had to. And so I'll never forget. I had to do it. I had to get Keith one. He had like a Today Show interview, and everyone else. At the beginning, I'd kind of go through that lady, like the manager, and then she said, "Oh no, it's okay, just go and knock." And so she said, "You'll be fine with Keith." He said, "He's up. He hasn't gone to bed yet. Like he'll be. He's fine. You don't have to worry about it." Well, I can do that one. So that was kind of where it started.
And that gave you a taste.
Yeah.
And then how long? After that, did you start your
sport,
own business?
Yeah, so again, through Brian. So Brian said, you did a great job with that. And then, I know you like sports, so I kind of got connected to rugby league, which was, I love the game. And then, from there, I just got a job at the NRL and this is really fortunate again. This is kind of now mid-2000s where sport was a bit different, And again, Mike, you probably attest to this. It was a business, but it was very much still in that...
development phase.
There wasn't as much money. I don't think it was probably, pay TV was just starting, so it was a very different kind of ecosystem to what it is now. So I was really fortunate, that I got to do a lot of different things. I worked in marketing, I worked in the sponsorship part, I worked in the media, and I did that for a couple of years and then got to my late 20s and thought there's more to... this not like I love the game, but I probably just wanted to see what else was out there. So I kind of just left and... I just thought I'd be consulting.
So when did you become a scientist, radiation, health, physics?
No, it's not the same bloke.
Or the international man of mystery.
This is actually my second podcast. I did that one. I did that one, yeah. That was.
We had Peter Beattie earlier, former Premier of Queensland. Warren Beatty, he's gone. Again, this is a fucking actor from America, mate. Warren Beatty.
I didn't know who
this
he was.
This is Peter Beatty.
I didn't know.
Ray goes, oh, sorry.
I know we're in Vegas, but how many drinks
started
have you
talking
had,
about shampoo. Know, or that, what was that jelly. Movie, Warren Beatty, mate? Hairdresser or something.
Yeah, wasn't it? Shampoo.
Shampoo,
movie,
that's
shampoo.
Right. He goes, how did you enjoy shampoo, Warren? It's Peter Beatty, Premier of Queensland, mate. Peter just laughed. He was hilarious.
Yeah.
So my next question is, how big a part did you play with the NRL, given that they're one of your clients, about coming here to Vegas?
I kind of went on my own, and then I love basketball, and about this stage I could start to see the kid or NRL and AFL players and cricketers, everyone started wearing NBA caps and jerseys, and I was like, this is it's pretty crazy, everyone seems to be following American sport.
LA
Dodgers.
And I
won a piece of business. I don't know if you remember, they turned the SCG into a Major League Baseball.
Remember it well.
Yeah.
So I was out there the day before.
Yeah.
Going, how weird's this?
Oh, it was amazing.
On the SCG.
What year was that about?
2004.
That's right. 10 years ago.
It was actually nearly 10 years. It was March 27th, nearly 10 years ago.
There you go.
Depending on when this comes out. So... it was so I won that piece of business, and then through that I just met a really good relationship through the baseball, and then said, right, basketball, NFL, there's got to be something to do in Australia, and booked myself a ticket, went over to New York and just said, hey, I obviously did my homework. I knew there was no one kind of representing the NBA. Everyone wanted to bring teams out and players out, but there was no one representing the economic side. So, looking at sponsors and content brand, the merchandise.
Fantastic. You can see those dollars.
So, so anyway, color story.
Of course. You don't do it for nothing, do you?
Yeah. So, anyway, color picked up that. I still do a lot of stuff with the NBA in Australia, and then to the NRL piece. So, I guess this was a.
Can I just ask you about the basketball? Is that bringing American players out to play with us as well? Are you involved in that?
Okay,
so management and stuff?
More brokering deals in Australia, for American...
Because some of the guys that are coming out now are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's dropped, hasn't it? It was really big at one stage. I remember going and seeing
The Australian League?
Yeah, the Australian
League. It's coming back up, definitely the 90s probably was the golden period, but it's they're definitely coming up. But
why did it flatten out, Tristan, a few years ago?
I think there was probably some governance issues. So it was run independently of Basketball Australia. Then Basketball Australia took over. And again, it's very different having a grassroots sport as opposed to a professional sport because, again, a professional sport, you need to have this, and this is again where Peter, why we're here today, you've got to have that sense of being an entrepreneur. And I guess when Basketball Australia had it, it was very heavily grassroots focused. So Larry Kesselman, he's a big property developer down in Melbourne. He went and bought the whole league, and he started to resurrect it. So they've done some great stuff in bridging the gap between the NBL and the NBA. So just to be clear, I don't work with the Australian league. I work with the American NBA. Yeah, so anyway, so for the NRL, so just I think when Peter and Andrew had this vision for this game, obviously I have a relationship. I'm also, I've always had a connection with the game, so I was the team manager for the State of Origin team, for the Blues a lot of time. Now I'm with Mal Meninga with the Australian team, so I've always had a connection with the game. And
what does that involve exactly, being the team manager? What's your role?
With Mal, everyone's different. It depends who the coach is and what they kind of need me to do. So I've got a... Again, I don't really have a... everyone asks, what do I do for a job? I don't really know. I've kind of got a unique skill set, I think, which I still don't really know what it is. But with Mal, I'm probably a conduit between Mal and the playing group. And I'm, we're big on values, and Mal's really big on culture. And we kind of work collaboratively around building an identity, particularly with the Australian Rugby League team, because I think, again, when Mal took over that role, it was the Wallabies and the Socceroos and the cricket team. To be honest with you, Mike, we used our first meeting we had when Mal took over was the baggy green, Wallabies had the scarf.
Let's make that important.
The Australian soccer team, the soccer team had the Socceroos.
The baggy green for us is the Holy Grail, man.
Yeah.
It's just like...
And that's why you...
You know what? People ask me this. Have you still got your baggy green? Oh, yeah. You're fucking joking, mate, aren't you? Yeah. Like, it's in my safe with my blue New South Wales cap and my one-day Australian cap. They're in a special bag in my safe.
Yeah.
And you bring it out to shape special people. Like, I can't believe they think you just throw it away or...
Yeah, but that's what he did with the jumpers, didn't he? You wanted to make that put them in your own safe.
It's amazing.
So the safe company...
Makes bigger saves. Make more money.
But can I just say, got any dirt on Mal? Anything, just anything on Mal, because he's just pretty squeaky clean, isn't he?
Yeah. Mal's
anything? Does he eat a lot? Does he smoke a lot?
No, he doesn't smoke.
Does he listen to heavy metal or something like
that? No, he's a family man, Mal. He's got young kids. Yeah. He lives in Canberra. His wife Mandy.
Made a good move.
I went away with him about 10 years ago for a weekend with a bloke that we do a bit of speaking for, and so we went away for this weekend. And I'd met Mal once or twice before, but this is Mal.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fucking in awe of Mal Meninga. Yes. And I looked at his legs. That's one.
His legs.
You're talking about Joel Garner again.
Yeah.
And don't go
Joel,
back there
tell
to
us
the
a
West
story.
Indians. No, in the shower, don't.
And you've been involved with the UFC as well, I believe. Or?
So that NBA just...
We moved off the West Indians in the shower to the UFC. Okay, Doss, where you go?
Yeah, no, I just found a niche with American sport, to be honest, again, which is, I think, why I got in, why Peter and Andrew just kind of wanted to get me involved in this project.
Yeah.
Because I've done reverse, so being based in Australia, I've worked for all the American leagues.
Yeah,
and over here it was like, hey... we've got a great league, we've got great, Fox Sports, a great broadcast partner, we've got teams that all want to participate, but what we don't, there's a small rugby league community here, but we just don't really have a network. So they kind of brought me on just to try and help, connect with the right people over here, and UFC was been a huge part of that.
How mad is the UFC?
How mad.
They're brutal, those dudes, aren't they?
Yeah.
I would not get in that octagon thing for fucking $10 million. No way.
What about Matraville some of those nights?
Yeah, well, that was pretty heavy, but we were younger. And how that UFC's just gone.
Well, it's funny. We actually we just had a bit of a session then with a couple of the executives from UFC, and they were talking about the early days of UFC and Dana White.
Yeah,
so Dana was one of the early adopters of Twitter, because obviously it was such a brutal sport, and it's still divisive, right? People either love it or they hate it. But back in those days, they struggled to get it on TV. So Dana got on Twitter, and would just start posting random clips, and he'd say, "Hey, if you want." I've got 15 free tickets. Meet me at the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and put out his personal phone number. And then he'd go down there and obviously just created this buzz.
To try and start the whole thing. He stood on corners and gave tickets away.
With Peter, you've got to have that sense of entrepreneurship. Like he believed in his product and he was, authentic in its pursuit.
When he rang you to say, we want to come to Vegas, What do you think? And I know we've done it here before, sort of semi-successful, but this is a big deal. This is the launch of the season. This is four of the best clubs. There's 15,000 Aussies hopefully going to come. We're hopefully going to get 40,000 people. But you don't know that.
Mm.
And you don't want to be a failure, because if it fails, it's a failure.
Yeah.
And you're signing a five-year deal.
Yeah.
And you want these people here to go, wow, all those Aussies come out, they put $100 million into our community. We've got this, we've got that, we've hotels are full, whatever.
Yeah.
But you don't know that's all going to happen.
No, no.
So I mean, what did they say to you? Tristan, no, help us.
No, honestly, the first thing he said, Tristan, what would your ideal week in Las Vegas or weekend in Las Vegas be? I was like, where do I start?
Jellies?
Yeah. No, so you know, boxing or...
Are you talking about the cannabis jellies?
No.
Mike Tyson's ears. We have this. Mike Tyson's made these cannabis.
So we just, you just spoke about, Andrew was on the call as well. We just kind of had some money. He said, oh, listen, we think you can bring a game out to Las Vegas, and I'll call you tomorrow. And
but
then,
you're at home, right? You're in Sydney.
Yeah, I was in my office, yeah. And then he called me the next day and said, yeah, can you come in for a meeting? And we kind of went from there. So, pretty quickly, like, I guess Las Vegas. We're here now, right? You see, it's the bright lights, and there's a show on every corner, and it's exciting. But it's also the most challenging city.
That's what I wanted to ask. Yeah. Was the complexities of organising a weekend here in difference to Brisbane or the Gold Coast,
yeah,
or Singapore?
Yeah,
tougher.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's probably. I'm not taking any. My role was purely trying to navigate the city and make sure that we're speaking to the right people, and the people where, I guess, empowering and trusting are the right people to do that with. So, you know, the first thing you learn when you speak to people in Las Vegas is, you know, this is the most competitive market in the world. You know, it's expensive, it's heavily unionized. So basically, you know, we're all going through this now. You pay a room tax, you pay a state tax, you got a tourism tax, you got a casino tax. There's a live music tax. Like, so for example, if you wanted to, say, Gary Beers and a couple of the guys did a tribute show last night. Yeah, from Excess did a tribute show last night at Cosmopolitan, and that was a huge success. But you know, you get
taxed for playing.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, tell on top of every other tax.
Tell us a bit more about that show with Gary.
Yeah,
please.
Yeah, I actually didn't get there. No.
Do you know what happened? Like, what was the?
Apparently,
he's
huge.
Not here. Is he here?
Does yeah, he's here.
Yeah, he lives here in the States now. He's got a recording studio.
Yeah, we should
get
him on the pod. Actually, it was just
That'd be fantastic.
Okay,
Gary Beers, and I think he told me one day that was a mistake on the first album. Gary.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, wow. And they just left it like that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So it's a tough.
Jeez, you're dropping some names, bro.
That's what we like.
We love it.
We do love it.
Yeah. Well, but again, he was important for us. So So Vegas is a tough city. And then it was just about finding the right partners. And
what about finding the right time as well? Because it's pretty much got to be around this weekend.
Well,
so how long ago did you start talking to people?
Yeah, Peter and Andrew did all their homework before they got in, and they identified this weekend. It's never a lull period in Vegas. This weekend, NASCAR, a UFC fight, there's Nitro Cross on. Last weekend was...
just a standard weekend.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, two weeks ago was the Super Bowl. Last weekend was... the golf, so there's just something every day or every weekend. So they'd identified this weekend as a good time. It obviously suits the NRL season.
Yeah.
And I guess when we started talking to different partners here, they said the same thing. They said, listen, you picked a really good weekend because, you know, it's pretty much chock-a-block.
So from the research we've done, the Las Vegas are trying to make this the sports hub of the USA, if not the world.
That was our pitch.
But who's they? Who's running this? Who's pushing all this?
Yeah, Las Vegas Tourism.
Las Vegas Tourism. I think they're just trying to pivot.
Jeez, they must be powerful.
Yeah, well, you look at that Formula One, a Super Bowl, they've got a LIV Golf Tournament now. They've got tennis. Alcaraz is playing Nadal tomorrow.
NASCAR. Everything.
And now the Major League Baseball team's coming in next year, and then they're talking in 2028 about bringing an NBA team here. So
it'll be the Los Angeles, whatever team they got. Wow.
Exactly. And that's where I think, again, Peter and, you know, and Andrew, like, they just saw we have a space here to kind of be the rugby league, like, to actually create our own identity. And that's why we're here, really. We want to be the, you know, the rugby event or the rugby league event in Vegas.
Fantastic.
We asked Peter Beattie about Peter Philandes and Andrew Abda. And we also just asked Mark Ellison, and they went, oh, man, they're like vision, you know, Volandis is such a doer.
Yeah.
They're both accountants, sort of that background. They're numbers people. They crunch the numbers. They know they're right. You know, without them, we basically wouldn't be here. And the other thing is, they told us that during COVID, rugby league nearly went broke. We were like, the arse was out of our pants. We were gone. Mm. This is only 3 or 4 years ago. Now we're in the best financial position, making investments outside of the game into hotels and all this sort of thing to get a return. Wow, is that all Peter Volandis and Andrew?
Yeah, no, honestly, they've got a big vision. They're ambitious, and like you said, Mike, they work harder than anyone. Like, and they I think they just see that the way the world's going, the world's getting smaller. You know, we're all on our phones now. You can't just rely on one market in anything, music, you know, film, TV, and sport. So, you know, they've got a vision, and again, like you said with Peter, in particular, you know, he knows that it's a huge task, but if you're going to try something, you know, you got to do it properly. And why not start with a big fish and work from there?
Well, so you'd also know about the cricket because we've got the sort of the T20 going here, and then the T20 World Cup is on here a bit later in the year. It's amazing to me that my world, the cricket and the NRL, have made an assault on the US pretty much within a calendar year.
Yeah. Well, as again, as Peter's been on the record saying, you know, we get 1% of this market. You know, that's the bigger than the population of Australia.
3 million people, that's right. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah.
And you've also been involved with Nick Kyrgios, I believe, as well. And how did that come about?
Great. So,
was it really great?
I've had an amazing, amazing run. Like, so I got to meet Nick through, I keep dropping big names, but just through.
No, we like that.
Yeah, we like it. It gives our podcast cred.
Well, through the NBA, I did some work with Kobe Bryant. Through Kobe, Nick was going through a bit of a transition, just kind of around the COVID period.
Yep.
Know, as you kind of saw, you know, he saw a bit of a shift in behaviour, and you know, he changed things up, and I kind of became a part of the team then. Nick and I, we're great friends. Like, great, he's a great guy. You know, he's
He seems like a really tight.
He's super smart.
I like him.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Like Anthony Mundine, it's all a show.
Yeah, similar.
Because people
similar.
Say to me, have you ever met Anthony Mundine?
Yeah.
I go, yes. They go, what's he like? Is he a wanker? I go, no, he's the loveliest bloke you've ever met. And it's just the show.
Yeah.
They're putting on a show. Yeah. And Nick knows that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the thing with Nick, I think the best way to kind of summarise it is that Nick is an unbelievably talented tennis player. Like,
ridiculous.
And was born an unbelievably talented tennis player. Yeah. And we all look at that and go, oh my God, if only I had that ability, if I only had that talent, I'd be doing this and I'd be doing that. Whereas...
Yeah, table tennis. Yeah. All the... No, because they get really good, don't they? It's not just squash, you know?
Yeah, whereas I think...
Nice outright, he's just...
I think with that talent comes the expectation, and expectation at a really young age, and pressure, and you got to conform. And I think that, you know, like Nick, like in, again, I'm paraphrasing Nick, but he'll say, it's not like I just pulled the number out and I became an amazing good tennis player. No, I worked super hard at it. Yeah, I had talent, but I worked harder than anybody else to get there. And I'm gonna do what I want to do. But no, we had an amazing run. Like, I was, you know, the Wimbledon run, and
that was a great
Australian run. Open with the doubles. Like, it was a great time. And as I said, we're still super tight. You know, I just want to see him get back on the court as soon as he can, because I know he's still got a lot to give.
He's injured, isn't he?
Yeah, his wrist and his knee. But I know he's back rehabbing. And, you know, hopefully he gets back on the court, maybe for the grass this year, like Wimbledon and that kind of. But yeah. If not, hopefully, definitely next summer.
It's got to be a tough sport too, travelling the world on your own. I imagine he has a support team with him, but being out there on the court yourself and, you know, mentally and everything, physically, it's a tough sport.
You don't appreciate how lonely it is. Like, that's the one thing.
Absolutely. I'm tennis. Lucky I played in a team sport. We had mates around us all the time,
I mean, even boxing, like, I've done a lot of stuff with Mundine in the past as well, and put different boxers. And boxers is, I always thought boxing was the toughest sport. And it is, obviously, because you can, here and there, you can get the... You know, you get the shit
punched. Smashed.
But the one thing I say about boxing is every 3 minutes, you get a corner. You know, or before the fight or after the fight, you get a dressing room where there's energy and there's guys that are... Yeah. Even if you're a 40-1 underdog, you know, you've still got some sense of, I'm not out there by myself. You know,
and you get that rub down and rub up.
Yeah,
the rub down.
There's not microphones, and there's not multiple cameras. And the thing I didn't appreciate until I started working with Nick with tennis is that, you know, you're by yourself. Like you share a dressing room, so the players all, you know, it's like high school in a way. Like you're about to play.
Yeah, old mates just there.
Could just be there.
And what are they doing? Are they looking at each other?
Yeah, sometimes.
See, I'd be going, fuck you.
Get in there.
Get out on the court, bro.
Get in there, mate.
Well, that's my natural competitive thing. But maybe being a tennis player, you'd have to...
Well, that's the thing. Everyone's different. Like, and it's so competitive. Like, it is so competitive. And we all know that the big, you know, the top three, or you might know the top five in the world. But if you get out of that top 10, like, it's not as lucrative as what people think it is. And you're traveling the world. It's really hard to have a family. And so competitive. So,
what about those people that sort of hang in the, you know, 100 to 200?
Yeah.
They've got to pay their own way. Straight. Yeah. And some of those people are on the circuit for years trying to make it. But let me ask you this question. When Nick's going into a semi or a quarter or even into the final, what's the electricity like?
Yeah.
You know, before he walks out and you're all in there, the team, that's just got to be, you know, he's peaking then, isn't he? Like it's
well, he's,
and he's trying to control that so he's not over peaking and you're just still in control.
Yeah, no, he's honestly so chill. Like he's very, doesn't have a coach, so... But as I said, his IQ is out of this world. Like apart from the talent, he just sees the game so well. Everything slows down for him. So honestly, it was just about trying to relax him. And it sounds ironic because I guess when you see him on the court, he's not relaxed at all. Like he's obviously very emotional and smashing rackets. And that's where, you know, when you're in his box, he's always looking at your box, and it's, you got to try and keep that energy up, or you got to try and reassure him. And
so when you're in the box, have you got him, and you know, he's got no cage, but you're there, and certain things, you know, that
he feeds off his box.
Look at the whatever the sign is,
he feeds off his box. I mean, again, you see it, you see it every game,
and mentions it, doesn't he?
You're up at every point. You know, he can hear, like he listens as well. Like, I think a lot of tennis players are very, they're like, I don't mean like they're like robots, they're
just
so disciplined and so programmed. Whereas Nick is in his own way, but I think also he's, you know, he just likes to feel that energy, you know, as you said, Mike. Like, I think he just sometimes he wants it up. Sometimes maybe the rally's not going his way. He wants to, you know, slow it down a bit if he can. It's obviously really tough. But, yeah, like I was saying before, the thing I didn't appreciate and why I think what is really hard to explain to people is just the loneliness of tennis.
Yeah.
And look, some of the viewers are really frustrated when he carries on like that, not understanding what he's going through.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people will switch off.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Only because they're so hyped up and he's freaking out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think back
just
to
give him McEnroe, a jelly.
Yeah, McEnroe, Bjork. I mean, if they had cameras and microphones like there are now, then...
Yeah,
you know, the narrative changes pretty quickly with them, to be honest, because now every moment, and that's in addition to social media and how people are capturing stuff on their phone. And
well, I think too, out in the court when you're on your own, like say in cricket, if you drop a catch, you've got your teammates come up and gee, you're upset, come on, widow, forget about it. But if you're going through a down phase in the game in tennis, you're on your own. Mentally, you've got to gee yourself
up. Isn't it Ray sort of saying, it's really hard to imagine what Nick Kyrgios is going through because you're not there. And people used to say to me things about playing the cricket. I go, bro, when you're out in the middle of the ground, there's 50,000 people there, and you drop a catch, like you want to try, you can't go anywhere. Then you're down on the boundary. That bloody wanker Whitney, and it might have been Viv Richards or Sachin Tendulkar or something like that.
Yeah, someone you have to get,
mate. The pressure, and then you feel like next time I come on and bowl, it's hard to explain, Ray, because we all feel like we know, but you don't.
Yeah.
And until you're there in that. And I hate to say it like this, that elite situation. And you think it's only the top 20 players, tennis players in the world really understand that. And the legends who have been there, or Federer, you know, Novak.
Yeah.
How do they deal with that maximum pressure all the time?
But we've got the new crop of Aussie players, eh? Yeah. Like, and they're pretty level-headed, aren't they? Can really handle.
I want Ash Barty to make a comeback.
And she is in golf, isn't she?
Is she playing golf? Yeah, apparently she's a great golfer too. Yeah.
And swimming.
But sorry, I cut you off then, Rick.
No, it's fine, mate. It's fine. But yeah, there's a good crop coming out.
Yeah. No, I think that's, well, it's like every sport now, isn't there? Like, I mean, I've got young kids of my own, and you see it, it's just the private coaching and the investment now that parents are making. I think this generation, and even with social media, like the generation that are coming through now in cricket and football and basketball and tennis, like these kids are, you know, parents are doctoring everything on their mobile phones since they can walk. So with that comes expectation and comes pressure and yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting time for sport. I believe
And is that what you do? Do you help the people who've got those problems? Is that any part of your job in doing that?
Not really. Like if they, people ask me, I personally think it's a challenging. Now, I'm going through now, like with a young 9-year-old son who loves basketball and you know, what you want to play, but it's when I was a kid, it was all about you want to win and you want to have fun. But, you know, now it's very, you know, a lot of private coaching and you don't want to push your son too far, but at the same time, you don't want him to fall behind. So it's, you go through the same thing.
Yeah, on basketball, actually, with Kobe Bryant, if you can just touch on that. Like, and you being a basketballer as a kid as well, what was it like working with someone like that?
That was amazing. That was amazing. So, yeah, like he was in town in Melbourne for 36 hours. So my job was, I was working for his agent, American agent. I helped broker the deal for him with the Australian promoter. And he's only in town for 36 hours. So, you know, literally got off the plane, met him at the hotel, immaculately dressed. My job was to do the deal, but then also he's fastidious about everything. And again, if you've read anything about Kobe Bryant, you understand. So he wanted to know, he'd only come out to purple and yellow lights for the Lakers or golds because he's the best. He wanted to know, we had Hamish McLaughlin was a host actually. Yeah, he wanted to know everything about Hamish. I don't mean what is he up to his level. He wanted to know who we'd interviewed in the past, what the questions were going to be, why he's asking that question after that question. He wanted to know what the walkout music was going to be. Wow. He wanted to know what the vision packages were. Like, I mean, absolutely micro-level detail on everything. And this is just one, for Kobe, who travels the world, like, this was just one, you know, one show that he's probably done a thousand times before. But anyway, the best story, I've got a few, but I could go – I'll tell you the short one. So the best one I can probably tell you is, again, like you, we're away at the moment. You kind of normally pack a pair of jeans, maybe a jacket, a couple of two shirts, you know, some underwear, and that. If you're away for 2 days, that's what I thought I'd be. So the first meeting I had with Kobe was to brief him on this show. So we'd emailed everything through to his representatives, but now it was time to kind of sit down with him in his suite and talk him through the show. Now, normally, you know, when you do this with an athlete, they're kind of dressed in tracksuit pants. Most of the time they're on their phone or baseball caps on. And, you know, and again, without meeting Kobe, you kind of, and that I guess the NBA, that's the kind of image you expect, these kind of guys that walk in and it's all about, it's just not all about them and, you know.
Swagger.
Yeah, swagger, exactly. That's what I'm looking for. So Kobe walked in. And this is just a meeting. Just keep in mind, this is just a briefing. Walked in the most beautiful suit I've ever seen in my life. Tie, polished black shoes. He had his hair, like, immaculate. I was like, oh, my word. Sat down, asked me, you know, how am I going? Asked me my family and my kids and an amazing conversation, right? I'll tell you something really cool in a minute. I'll show you when we get off here. I'll show it to you as well. Anyway, so you know, went through the show and it was all great. And then I wore, obviously, the one jacket and the one shirt and the one pair of shoes that I had. And this wasn't the show. You know, this was only the briefing. So I was only with him for probably 20 minutes, 25 minutes, went through it all and then go back the next day to do the actual show. I walked out, I was like, oh, man, I've got to go and buy a new wardrobe. Like, I can't see this guy.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, but it's crazy.
I can't. I thought you were going to say he bought you a wardrobe.
No. So this is nuts, though. This is nuts, right? I'll tell you the one. Have we got time?
This is a
really good story. So again, like, we sent everything, you know, he's in Melbourne for that short period of time, so it was kind of, what do you want to do? And again, most athletes will play golf or love Australian wine, so go to a winery. So we put all these on the list, and then I just, like, randomly put, like, a great white shark dive. And I didn't even know, like, just thought, you know, there's no way he's going to want to do this. Anyway, get off the plane, he's, like, his kind of assistant ran up to me, she goes, Kobe really wants to do the great white shark dive. I was like, what?
No.
She's like, yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, fuck, okay. So
wish I hadn't put that on last. Yeah.
I don't know why. I just thought you could just go off, like, Port Phillip Bay and...
Yeah.
Does his insurance cover that?
Yeah. So I Googled it. And I was like, okay, good news. They do it. Oh, sorry, bad news. There's only two places in the world that you can dive with a great white shark. One is in South Africa.
And the other one's South Australia.
Exactly, off Port Lincoln. Yeah, so I'm like, great. So I had a good contact at the South Australian Tourism commission. So I rang her.
Well done.
And I was like, hey, you're not going to believe it. Like, this is all secret, like very secret squirrel stuff. But Kobe Bryant's in town. He has a show tomorrow in Melbourne at 12. So we need to be back by probably 11 a.m. Oh, sorry. He had a meet and greet. It must have been 2 o'clock. So we need to be back by 12. The following, we need to be back at 12 that day. Is there any way we could get Kobe, you know, to dive with the Great White Sharks? And she's like, oh my God, let me make a couple of calls. So rings me back an hour later. She says, yeah, we can do it. He's got to be up at 2 in the morning. He's got to, so we had a chopper. He flew on a private jet.
Yeah.
2 in the morning, you've got to get on the jet, the chopper from Melbourne to Port Lincoln. Once you get to Port Lincoln, it's an hour and a half boat out to where you dive with the Great White Sharks. When you get to where you dive, it's another 40-minute orientation. Then you can dive down for like half an hour, come back up. And I'm like, there's no way in the world he's going to want to do this. Like, you know, he's only in town for 36 hours. He's got to do, you know, he's got to do the show that
I'm
day.
I'm shaking my head now. 36 Anyways, hours?
Yeah, sure enough, yeah. No. Lock it in. So 2 a.m., right? So we have to leave at 2 a.m. He's going to do the Great White. So an hour and a half there. So get there by 4 or 5, 4:35.
Nah.
Get on the boat, out, 6 a.m., do the dive. 8 a.m., back, get there. Back in Melbourne by 12. Fuck, okay. Well, it's happening, right? Anyway, about one...
You're one stressing me out. Like, I'm really getting really bad anxiety.
Go on. Yeah. So one in the morning, I get a call, and it's the bloke on the boat. And, you know, again, this guy's like a tuna fisherman, I think. You know, and he's like, oh, mate, I got some bad news. I said, what's that? He says, the wind's come up. It's no good. He goes, if you can stay another 12 hours, then we'll be able to go. I was like, oh, Kobe's due to fly. He was flying out that night, straight after the show, he's on his jet back to LA. If he can come out similar time, like 3-4 in the morning the next day, so just push his flight back 12 hours, we can do it, and you can fly back from Adelaide. So I said, he's going to be pissed off, like he's probably already up. So I, you know, rang his manager, and she said, oh, that's okay. We'll see what we can do, you know. So anyway, I said, does he want to stay the 12 hours? And his manager said, no, he wants to get back and... coach his daughter's basketball team.
Oh, wow.
It's heartbreaking.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, heartbreaking.
So, Sharks, climbing the Harbour Bridge. Anything else?
No,
bungee jumping. Did anyone say to you, I want to go bungee jumping?
Yeah, no, not yet.
In the end, his daughter was with him.
Awful, yeah.
And that wasn't directly
after. No. That happened probably 3 or 4 months later. But what happened after that is I got it was a tragic accident, I actually got a video of that. Remember I told you about the session that I had where I briefed him?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't realise they were filming. And I actually got a video of him and I, which I'll show you after this.
Which was only, 3 or 4 months before he actually was in that accident and died with his daughter. What a story.
I'll show you when we get off. But,
Insane story.
Yeah, yeah.
No, the fact crazy. He wanted to go and do that in a 36-hour window, with these people, like, I just go, no way, man. I'm sleeping in.
Yeah.
But obviously, you're a good manager of stress because, like, as Ray attested to him with the anxiety, he's like, you must be constantly thinking, this. I can't fuck this up.
That's... Your story is very similar to us trying to get here to Vegas from the time we left. No idea. We're going to do a podcast on
just about the trip.
It was unbelievable. Yeah, very similar. You know, except KB's not here.
We got any more questions for Tristan? I mean, it's been fascinating, bro. Yeah.
Really?
Fascinating.
No, it's been unreal.
Just about the game tomorrow. You obviously going to be there.
Yep.
Yeah, cool. So, and then what's your role with the NRL then going forward for the rest of the year?
No, I've had a great relationship with Andrew and Peter, so I want to stay involved. I think, obviously, they're doing this for 5 years, so I'm sure I'll still be involved in this, hopefully forever. I love the game. Yeah. It's in my blood.
Who do you support?
Well, it's a tough question.
Say the right team.
Tigers.
Tigers.
Yeah.
I like the Roosters. That's why Junior.
I love the Roosters. It's a tough one.
Let me ask you this question, last question. I feel like we've got it right. Tomorrow's going to be huge, but so far everything's just slotted into the right place. Where will this, if we get it right in 5 years' time, how big could this be? Could this be 50,000 Aussies coming over for this weekend and fireworks and, you know, just it could be ginormous.
Well, that's what's exciting. Like, I think the one positive, I'm not sure if Peter mentioned this, one positive I think so far is just how well this idea has been received by Aussies.
Yeah.
Like when you think about, like I remember the first, the early meetings we had with Qantas and with the travel partners, and we were saying, you know, we want to get 15,000 Aussies. They were like, that's a big number. They didn't say you couldn't do it, but they said that's a big number. Like that's, and you know, like not only they moved like that. And when you see them, when you saw them all at that fan event yesterday, you know, I think this is going to become an annual event that's going to bring thousands and thousands of Australians over, which is obviously going to make the city happy. You know, we've been here, like Americans love Aussies. I love the accent. They love, you know, I think they see value in what we're trying to bring. So I think that side of it's going to be a big tick. I think, you know,
Aussie weekend in Vegas annually. The Aussie week. Because we've got good AUSA here, haven't we, where we promote in New York and LA.
Yeah, they've been fantastic as well. They've been of great
support.
Aussie
NRL weekend. I mean, you'd be booking it 2 years before, wouldn't you? Oh, and not next year, the year after.
And the Oz Icons. And the Oz Icons playing. Because Aussie Day, Oz Icons.
That's the name of our ball.
Australian music.
Yeah, there you go.
With Commissioner Junior up the front. Hey.
Fantastic. But a really good, just my last question to you is, do you have a box there that we could come and join you in? Really?
We have to ask Peter for that, but I'm sure Peter? You've got it.
Peter said no.
No, we'll have to ask you. Ask Tristan.
He's got a whole box on his own.
I'm sure we could sort something out.
See you there, buddy.
Tristan, thank you very much, mate. Thanks for pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Elsa!
Get that finger up.
Until next time in the Vegas series, ciao.
Ciao, baby.